territorial waters, Southeast Asian nations such as Vietnam and the Philippines disagree. And the long-standing dispute has threatened to boil over in recent months as China flexes its muscle in the region. Secretary of State Clinton addressed the issue at a meeting of Southeast Asia foreign ministers in Cambodia. She said the U.S. isn't taking sides, but does have an interest in maintaining respect for international law and in maintaining peace and stability in the region. And she urged all involved to resolve their differences without intimidation and without the use of force. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Cheng Sen, Thailand.
Pakistani officials say scores of villagers in a volatile northern region are being held hostage. They say militants appear to be targeting members of an anti-Taliban group. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, featuring the Zodi Chair and the Very Task Chair by Hayworth, online at sitforless.com.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. On July 12th, jazz legend Lamont Parsons and his collaborators take to the lobby stage. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
In January of 2010, Haiti was devastated by a powerful earthquake, the worst in more than 200 years. It's estimated more than 300,000 people died and over a million people were left homeless. Now, over 2 years later, the country is still struggling to rebuild in spite of billions of dollars in aid promised by the international community. In this hour of the program, we will be talking about Haiti, trying to get an update, and also looking at the ways that the country's past continues to shape its present. And our guest for the program is Laurent Dubois. He teaches history at Duke University and has written a good deal on Haiti. He's written for the LA Times, The Nation, The New Yorker website. He is also the author of the book Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution, and a brand new book, which has just come out. The title of his book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. Metropolitan Books is the publisher. And as I say, it's an attempt to try to get people to understand the country's history and how it is that has shaped present life in Haiti, and the way that Haitians think of their country, the way the rest of the world thinks of Haiti, and also the complicated and somewhat contentious relationship between Haiti and the United States. And Professor Dubois, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. I'm not quite sure where the place to start would be, except that there are maybe a couple of things that people, certainly Americans, as they're trying to understand Haiti, really should know, should appreciate, and perhaps aren't very conscious of. And I guess the thing is, if you ask, what's the maybe one of the most defining things, important things to know about Haiti, it would have to be how the country came to be, and the fact that this was a country that was born out of a slave rebellion.
Yeah, I really agree. I think that's quite essential. From the very beginning, this is a country that kind of defies the broader world and stands against things that dominate elsewhere in a way, since the United States is still a country where slavery dominates and other countries are as well. So the birth out of the slave revolution and the attempt to create a different society that rejected slavery really is the foundational, the beginning of the story. It's a story that I start with, of course, in the new book.
Yeah. And this is, from the very beginning, people have to appreciate the fact that that the rest of the world, or at least the dominant powers of the time, all of these countries, one way or another, invested in slavery and the slave trade. They didn't rush to embrace Haiti, and the United States didn't really acknowledge Haiti, really not until the time of the U.S. Civil War.
That's right. I mean, and the U.S. is actually the last nation in the world to recognize Haiti. And somewhat paradoxically, since it's the country that after that becomes probably the most directly involved in the country in many ways. But that sense of hostility is very important. It just was not only the fact that slavery was abolished there, but it was abolished through a violent uprising of slaves against their masters. And that made many masters in the Americas extremely nervous. It also inspired a lot of slaves in other parts of the world. And Haiti was a positive symbol for many people as well. So from the very beginning, there's a lot of things projected onto Haiti from the outside world, and that, of course, shapes its destiny in important ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps you could talk about that some more, because I think that also you're arguing that many of the commonplace notions that people have about Haiti, about what kind of a place it is, really date all the way back from the point that we have this rebellion and then the country becoming independent of France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, of course, is that in the United States, a lot of people do have notions of Haiti or images of Haiti. They're kind of almost – there's some kind of collective unconscious or something, I think, for people, and that is largely negative or very often negative. And it's interesting because, I mean, if you ask someone, you know, about their images of Bolivia or something, they might not have the same kind of powerful images. But Haiti, I think, from the very beginning kind of marks the U.S. imaginary in many ways. But what's interesting and what I'm trying to kind of confront and go against in the book is that we have a kind of powerful sense of Haiti as that's very kind of symbolic and general and vague, and very little actual knowledge often about the details of its history and all the complexities of that history.
Well, is that for lack of interest, or is that simply that outsiders projected so many things onto Haiti?
I think there's a lot projected onto it because, again, it's seen as a sort of threat. And not just the overthrow of slavery, but then the kind of alternative way of organizing the society that comes about. And at the same time, it's also, I think, also a way to some extent of avoiding dealing with some of our very own kind of implications in the country, especially the U.S. occupation of Haiti, which very few Americans know about. But from 1915 to 1934, the U.S. directly occupied and basically ran the country for 20 years. And there's never been much of a knowledge about that or a real reckoning with that. So I actually think there's something more at work, which is that we don't deal with the history and we deal instead in certain kinds of stereotypes.
Yeah. Something else I think it's – we can talk some more about the relationship with the United States, but I think something else it's important people to think about is the point at which Haiti was that it was building up from, right at the point that it became independent. And here was a place where a lot of people died. There was a lot of bloodshed in the cause. And so you're starting at that point, and it would be difficult enough. But they also had an enormous challenge visited on them by the former colonial masters. And that was an enormous fine, in a sense, a debt put on them by the French, a price to be paid for independence. And that it's enough starting from where they were, but also starting with this enormous debt, you know, one would have mm-hmm. to ask, well, how do you possibly start to grow and develop a country and develop an economy when you're starting out right out from the very beginning with this crushing debt that you
right.
owe to France?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think from 1804, there's enormous challenges. One is simply that actually the French haven't given up, and there's a sense of the early leaders really feel that they have to protect the country. They have to invest in military infrastructure, maybe even above all else, because they're worried actually of a reconquest and a re-enslavement. The second is this the challenge of finding one's way in the kind of broader world, again, because of this hostility. And then, as you said, France refuses to recognize the independence until 1825. But when they accept the independence, it's at a very steep cost in that they levy this indemnity. And the Haitians are going to pay that debt off, but it will take a very, very long time. In fact, they can't pay the debt. They can't pay the indemnity, so French banks loan them money. And they quickly get into this cycle of debt that many countries are familiar with in the 20th and 21st century. But through the 19th century, that really does affect state finances very, very badly. And so you do have all those burdens from the very beginning, not to mention the whole or broader question of how to transition from a slave plantation economy into something else.
Mm. Our guest is Laurent Dubois. He's professor of history at Duke University. He's written a lot about Haiti. His new book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. It's published by Metropolitan Books. And again, questions are welcome for people who are listening. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And also you can send us an email if you'd like to do that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. There's something else here that you said that you think that Americans should at least know about, and something that they don't, and that is for a period of about, I think, around 20 years, beginning in 1915, the United States occupied Haiti. Essentially, the United States ran the country for those years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it basically was a colonial occupation. I mean, the Marines essentially controlled the government in Port-au-Prince. Most of the districts of the country were overseen by Marines. While there were still Haitian officials working with them, of course. And there was also a pretty strong military resistance or insurgent resistance in the country against the U.S. occupation that was crushed in the process of that, as well as various opposition movements. It's a very, very important moment in Haitian history. It really helps to sort of transform, or it sets in motion a lot of transformations, many of them quite negative, sets the stage for what we've seen in the 20th century. One of the big points in the book, I think, is, first of all, that the 19th century is actually a time of relative success and economic expansion, and a time when people migrate to Haiti. And the early 20th century starts to shift things in many ways. And what we're seeing, I think, today at the end of the 20th century, some of those processes, or many of them, begin in the early 20th century. So we need to understand that quite clearly.
Well, what was the commercial interest that the United States had in Haiti?
So after overthrowing the plantation regime, there's a crop that dominated that, which was sugar, which was really the most profitable crop of the 18th century. And sugar is essentially decisively destroyed in Haiti during the revolution, and it never really comes back. There's small-scale cultivation of cane for rum and a little bit of sugar. But on the other hand, there are other crops like coffee, the logging, and other industries. And what happens is that the former slaves construct an actually quite viable agricultural system based on small farming that mixes production for the country with production of export commodities, especially coffee, but also other goods as well. And so that's the interest. People, merchants, are eager to sell goods to Haiti and to purchase those goods and ship them outwards.
What, perhaps you could talk a little bit more about how it is in Haiti. People thought, you said really the big challenge was, well, how do you take a society that was based on slavery and was organized around slavery and make a free society? How did people approach that question?
Well, that's part of the story of within Haiti, right? So there's these pressures outside. In Haiti, there's a big conflict over that, right? And there are leaders early on who believe that essentially the plantation system needs to be maintained with free labor now, but still labor that's free but also coerced. In other words, they're essentially trying to find ways, different sorts of methods to keep people working on the plantations, even though they're nominally free. Now, of course, the population, that the majority slave population, have a very different idea of freedom. And their idea is really to take over the plantations, to make them their own, and to have independent lives as farmers and as eventually sometimes as merchants and landowners. So that conflict shapes a lot of Haitian history. But it's the second side that in many ways wins, or at least wins a tentative history victory, excuse me, so that the most of rural Haiti does eventually get carved up into smaller farms that these former slaves create and cultivate. Mm-hmm.
This Haiti, I think, as people maybe perceive it, and this may or may not be completely true, or maybe you need to look at it a little bit more closely. But again, I think people often think of one of the things that really characterizes the country is an extreme kind of social economic stratification, to the extent that where you have a very small number of people who are quite wealthy and who control all of the important resources, and then you have a lot of other people that are just barely making it. Does that kind of divide between haves and have-nots go really back to the beginnings of the country?
It does, although I think it's actually gotten probably worse in the 20th century in some ways. In the 19th century, there are a lot of intermediary groups. You know, there are people who are certainly not very powerful, but who might have their own land and have a certain amount of independence and economic independence. But certainly from the very beginning, there is a pretty strong conflict within the country. And what happens as well is that the state being in charge of the state or being in the military becomes one of the main routes for social advancement. So for those who do want to kind of get power, going into the state becomes one of the major ways to do that, which means that the state becomes a kind of prize over which different groups fight and does account for some of the many conflicts over control of the state that you see throughout the country's history.
You talked a little bit earlier about we talked a little bit about the American occupation, this period of about, roughly speaking, about 20 years, where the United States essentially ran the country. Well, then after that, we come to the Duvalier era. And I guess if there's anything or one of the few things that people will know about the country or will think about was this family, father and son, that ran the country for a period from roughly the late 50s all the way into the mid 80s. What sort of role did the United States play a role in the Duvaliers coming to essentially run the country?
Well, overall, yes. I mean, the United States, first of all, Duvalier is in some ways a product of the U.S. occupation. He went to a med school that was set up during the U.S. occupation. He actually studied at the University of Michigan for a year, and his professional career kind of expanded because he was working with U.S. doctors on a campaign against Yaws, and got kind of prominence through that campaign, which is a very important campaign. He's actually, at first, there are elements in the U.S. embassy that are pretty suspicious and worry about Duvalier. But when he comes to power, they begin to effectively support him quite heavily. There's a Marine mission that goes down soon after his election. There is a moment in the early 60s where the Kennedy administration kind of works against him. But Duvalier manages to outflank those kinds of periods of opposition. And then after that, effectively, U.S. policy settles into a policy of strong support for Duvalier that lasts all the way until the mid-80s when the son is overthrown. So the U.S. is definitely quite involved in that regime. And that's something I think people need to know. Part of the explanation is a Cold War one, simply that Duvalier becomes an important ally right next to Cuba there in the Caribbean. And as long as he kind of talks about anti-communism, the U.S. Kind of overlooks his very violent human rights regime abuses.
If there, in addition to the Duvalier father and son, I guess if there's any other individual a name that people will recognize, it's Jean-Bertrand Aristide, this Roman Catholic priest who was elected to the presidency, but shortly after taking office, there was a coup, and he spent most of his first term in the United States, and has been somebody who has then for a long time was peripheral to the country's politics, I think. Then, though, just recently we had a presidential election, and I definitely want to talk some about that. He ended up actually coming back to the country, and I think a lot of people in Haiti weren't really sure whether or not that was a good idea. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about him and how he fits in to the kind of history that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's absolutely a central figure in the last 20 years or so of Haitian history. He emerges through as part of the anti-Duvalier movement in the late 70s, early 80s, which was very strongly rooted in the Catholic Church in Haiti. So a lot of priests were in the opposition. He becomes a hero of that period, along with others. So there's a lot of opposition members, and then sort of becomes a kind of voice for that opposition afterwards, and participates in the debates of what's supposed to happen after the fall of Duvalier. He's elected president in 1990, as you said, is only in power briefly before the military, the kind of remnants of the Duvalier regime, we can say, overthrow him. And he's only reinstated in 1994 through a U.S. occupation, a second U.S. Occupation in 1994, a much shorter occupation that's ordered by Bill Clinton. But then he serves as president. He steps down in 1996, one of his party members, Préval, is elected. But then he's reelected president in 2000, and then was sort of overthrown or kicked out in 2004, again with an uprising by military officers there. Although the circumstances of 2004 were rather different from 1991. But so his return in after the earthquake was after this long and very very complicated history of periods of exile and periods of rule in the country.
And is he somebody who has enough standing now in the country to to play some kind of role going forward?
I think his role is in society. He certainly has a certain standing, and he's doing various projects. It should be noted that he returned. So the U.S. really had for years tried to avoid his return. He had been trying to return for some time. He was in South Africa, but Jean-Claude Duvalier returned after the earthquake. The former dictator returned from France. It became very difficult to justify allowing Jean-Claude Duvalier to go back without allowing Aristide to go back. So that's part of it. I think actually the U.S. State Department probably overestimated the concerns around Aristide's return because he returns a very different figure, in some ways diminished in popularity. I mean, he has a following, but it's in 1990, he had a massively popular following, you know, and throughout the 1990s, still a strong following. But that has declined. So his role will, I think, be one of participating in the larger society. But he doesn't have the kind of powerful role that he had a long time. Well, not that long ago, but in the early 90s, where he really was a very, very powerful voice. So the question of who really, you know, where political power is going to come from and who's going to speak on behalf of the Haitian people is obviously a continually very difficult one.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Someone who is listening in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi, Professor DeVoy. I'm halfway through your book and really enjoying it. Lived in Haiti for 15 months and continue to work down there. But I was wondering, you were talking about President Aristide, and one of the rumors that I heard when I was down there and the reasons was that he was deposed twice, basically, was his talk about reparations, particularly from the French, as far as some sort of repayment of the reparations that Haiti had to pay over the, I guess, until 1947, until they ended up paying that off. Do you have any information on that, what role that played in his being deposed twice? And is there any continued effort to try to get France to acknowledge that debt and pay some of it back?
It's true. It was really during his second period as president in 2000 and that he made that demand for reparations. He had a very specific amount that he requested from the French government. Whether that played a direct role in his ouster, it's very hard for me to say. I mean, there's always been that rumor that was one of the reasons. I think it's much more complicated than that. Obviously, foreign governments, including the U.S. and France, had many, many people who were anti-Aristide from the very beginning. Aristide was very critical of U.S. policies. He's someone who emerged from the left in Haiti, clearly. So there's no doubt that played a role in both France and U.S. Approaches to him, and just larger financial policies that were imposed on Haiti during his regime played a very crippling role. And I mean, that's something that's been, I think, well documented in a number of recent books as well. So, you know, maybe the reparations I think of as a kind of symbol of Aristide kind of confronting these outside nations. I think that's how it's best to think about it, that it's a way of thinking about the fact that his stance against or in criticism of those countries' policies certainly played a role in the broader situation that made his regimes difficult.
Okay, thank you very much. One more question, if I could.
Sure.
During Aristide's first exile, when he came back to the United States, the Clinton administration imposed sanctions on the generals to try to get them out. And I think it's pretty well agreed upon that those sanctions really crippled any of the industry that was left in Haiti. Didn't really hurt the generals all that much, but certainly hurt the population. Do you have any suggestions or thoughts about what would be smart sanctions for situations like that, as opposed to what I would call dumb sanctions that we did at that time?
Yeah, it's a really difficult issue. I mean, I think, because sanctions do often have that effect, right? And it certainly was really devastating at that time in Haiti's history. There had been a buildup of certain industries in the 80s, and then that essentially vanished, both in the late 80s because of the political conflicts, but in the early 90s as well. You know, I think the best solution is, I think, to not get to that stage. And there's so many things the U.S. could have done differently all along before we got there, and then different ways that the return of Aristide could have been handled as well. So, I think it's always a really difficult challenge to figure out how to deal with a military regime like that. But it's the crucial thing, in a way, is that was partly the inheritance of having spent 30 years supporting an authoritarian regime in Haiti. So I think when you do that, there's always consequences down the road.
Thank you very much, and thanks again for your book.
No, thank you for the call. Other folks who are listening are welcome to call with questions, 333-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have the email, and if you'd like to send us a message that way, you can. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guest in this hour of focus is Laurent Dubois. He's a professor of history at Duke University. He's written a lot about Haiti, including the book that we're talking about here this morning. It's titled Haiti, the Aftershocks of History. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Well, I do believe that you were in Haiti maybe within the last month or so?
Yes.
Now we're a little over 2 years after that quake. And as I mentioned, a lot of people were killed. A lot of people left homeless. A lot of the country's infrastructure was really hit very, very hard. When you go around Haiti today, what do you see? And what can you say about what kind of rebuilding has taken place?
Well, there's still, a lot of devastation, especially in the downtown area. So it's still very, very striking and hard to see. The National Palace has not been rebuilt. The National Cathedral, the Episcopal Church, which had beautiful paintings, which were destroyed. So you see a lot of that destruction still there. Other parts of the city are rebuilding slowly, and there are new building projects that have come up, for hotels and other things that have gone up. So it's a really mix. I mean, the camps are still very visible, very present. The population has declined. I mean, there's maybe 500,000 left. I think I've read the estimates. And in some ways that, the problem of the camps is even more intense, in part because of the people who've been there a long time, and the question of exactly how to deal with those is very difficult. So there's these enormous challenges. I think, I thought it was always going to be the case, and I think others who knew Haiti knew that this was going to be many, many year process of reconstruction. Just the size of the catastrophe was so massive and so many complicated issues that you have to confront in rebuilding, that no doubt, I mean, we'll be seeing the mark of the earthquake, I think, for at least a decade. In Haiti.
The guest that we have with us in this hour is Laurent Dubois. He is a professor of history at Duke University, has written on Haiti for the LA Times, The Nation, The New Yorker website. He's author of the book Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution, and newly published Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, published by Metropolitan Books. And in fact, again, as we talked a little bit at the beginning, much of his idea here is to try to introduce people to the history of Haiti. And he really makes the argument that if you're going to try to understand what's happening in Haiti today, you really have to understand the background as well, something of the country's history. It's coming out of a slave revolt and its long and complicated relationship with the United States. Haiti, in the fall of 2010, so this was not all that long after the earthquake, so they're trying to recover from the earthquake. They have a cholera epidemic that they're struggling with, and in the middle of all of that, they have a presidential election, or at least what turned out to be the first stage of a presidential election. And amazingly enough, they actually managed to make it possible for, I think, maybe something over 1 million people to vote. Maybe close to 5 million people at total. So that's just a fifth, I guess. But it seems to me like just the fact that they managed to pull off that presidential election, given everything else that they were struggling with, it seems to me pretty significant.
Well, it was, although there really were huge challenges with that election. And I mean, the population is more like 10 million. So it was still a small, unfortunately. And given, I mean, there have been other elections where they had much, much larger participation, notably in 1990. That election took place, but in circumstances that were pretty troubling and difficult. But nevertheless, I think people hoped that, having gotten a new president and then forming a government would obviously be a first step towards reconstruction.
Yeah, I guess.
And,
Maybe it's just is it that's like 5 million people who actually would be eligible to vote? Is that what I'm getting that
maybe
number
that's
from?
No, yeah, you're right actually, because the population is very young in
right,
Haiti.
Okay.
So you're right. There was about but I think and actually the youth vote was the young people over 18. The youth vote was very important in electing Martelly, who was very popular among younger people in the country.
Well, that's what it was. It was really interesting that here initially it seemed that you had two main sort of contenders here, and one was the establishment candidate, the candidate who was backed by the current president, and then you had this woman, Mirlande Manigat, who was a former first lady of Haiti. And then at one point, the official certifying the election said, OK, these two people, they got the most votes. And so we'll have a runoff. And that was met by a huge outcry, charges of fraud, so forth and so on. And then it wasn't very long before the election commission there completely turned around and said, no, well, wait a minute. Jude Celestin, who was the establishment candidate, and Ms. Maniga, they weren't the top two. Actually, it was this man who was the musician, Mr. Martelly, and Ms. Manigat. So then it was, okay, those are our top two. And then there was going to be this runoff, which then did happen in the spring of the next year, which would be 2011. How did all of that work out that way?
Yeah, it was very – I mean, it's still very confusing. It was very confusing to watch, and it's very difficult, I think, to know exactly what was going on behind closed doors. There was a mix of, you know, of dealing behind closed doors and then street action and pressure and demonstrations and a lot of maneuvering around the political story, which is often the case and has been in the case in prior elections. So it's unfortunate in a way because it's difficult to really be sure of what happened, and I think still there's a sense in which you know, it was not a very clear election, and it would be great if the next election and parliamentary elections could have a lot more transparency and work with a lot less drama. But unfortunately, that, you know, the circumstances in which it took place, I think, did make it really frustrating for a lot of participants, and a lot of people didn't vote who would have liked to vote and couldn't vote, and there was issues of IDs and all kinds of confusion. So. Mm.
So they did indeed have the runoff, and the winner was this man, this pop star, Michel Martelly, very apparently quite popular in the country. He was sworn in as president. So who is this man?
Well, you know, Martelly's campaign really had the whole idea was that he was a kind of outside, you know, that he was not a political insider. He was a musician. He'd made his name as a well-known and beloved musician, so his conversion into a political figure was kind of unexpected, and I'm not sure that people really, you know, were completely expecting it in that sense. And it's been quite a conversion. And he's someone who has a lot of links to the United States, so that's important. But he also is someone who, since he's come into power, has certainly run into the fact that there are a lot of, you know, the political parties and other political people who are part of the political system who have been making his first year complicated, and his conflicts with the parliament, just getting a prime minister appointed, have been very intense. He came from outside, but now that he's inside, he's got a lot of stuff to deal with within the government, and there's been a lot of paralysis for the first while within that government as well.
So you go to what my next question would have been was, how's he done?
Well, you know, he's had some popular programs. He created one very popular program where he's actually taxing remittances from the Haitian diaspora. So when people send home money to relatives, and also taxing phone calls from the U.S. to Haiti, and using that to pay for schooling for children. And he's very proud of that initiative, and very he advertises it quite a bit. You see posters all over Port-au-Prince showing how many children have been sent to school. So he has programs like that are a lot of people like the idea of, and certainly schooling is very important. And there have been, you know, new construction projects and some new investment coming in. So, at the same time, you know, it does feel like the progress for many people feels extremely slow, and the reconstruction seems extremely slow. So there's also, I think, a certain amount of frustration. Politics is always divisive in Haiti. So you can find very, very different opinions about his rule so far.
Yeah. Just again, going back to this really, it's seeming, at least for me, just to read what was reported in the popular press, this really turbulent period that was in the run up to the election that was in the fall of 2010. There were really two individuals who were important figures in Haiti's past who either showed up or said they wanted to show up, and one of the people was the former president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who, as you say, had been living for some time in South Africa, said he wanted to go back, was ready to go back. And a lot of people, I think, including the government of the United States, thought this wasn't such a hot idea. He did eventually come back to the country in the spring last year. Well, also, curiously enough, after almost 25 years of being away, Jean-Claude Duvalier shows up. And I read the stories and I thought, why? Why did he come back? And what kind of reception did he think that he was going to receive? This man who had been driven out of the country and had been, the scion of this really hated man, and whose family had run the country for all those years. What in the world? That my question at the time was, what in the world was this guy thinking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there was some kind of financial issue that brought him back. I think it had to do with a set of kind of legal financial issues of him trying to get access to some money that had been blocked in a Swiss bank account. So that was the immediate inspiration. He was then told that he couldn't leave the country, and there's a possibility of him being brought up on legal charges, but it's very unclear whether that's going to happen right now. It's really very strange. I mean, and if you talk to people in Haiti about this today, you'll find very different responses. I mean, the striking thing is that there is a strand of nostalgia for the Jean-Claude Duvalier years. Many people who weren't born at the time have an idea that they were more stable, that there was outside investment. So you will find people who defend that period. And at the same time, other people who feel like, there has to be a reckoning with the human rights abuses, and people in the human rights community who sort of feel as if there needs to be some kind of trial. And then Aristide's own time in the country was also a moment of great controversy. So there's people who feel like there needs to be dealing with things that happened during that period. So you have it's a really kind of odd situation, I have to say, where you have both these figures in Haiti. I think a lot of people also really just want to move forward. They want to move on, let's say, and the question really is the future. But it is hard, I think, as long as these kind of questions from the past are lingering so powerfully in the presence of these figures, to not have to sort of confront and make sense of that. And again, this very youthful population, that's important to keep in mind. So there's a lot of people who weren't alive during that period, but have their own sense of what those periods were like that may or may not correspond to the reality.
Yeah, I think, as you say, I think some people looked at Jean-Claude Duvalier and said, well, yeah, really the issue is here, he's got some money squirreled away in Switzerland, and there's some sort of issue that he had to establish his connection with Haiti or his residency or something like that. So he slips into the country, and I don't know, a guy like that can actually slip in without being noticed. And
right,
then there was this spin that said, oh, well, I've come back because I really want to help the people of Haiti.
Help reconstruction, yeah.
Exactly. And so you also sort of wonder, well, could it be conceivable that he could actually play some kind of constructive role in the future of the country?
There's also, I think for him there was a political kind of gamble, which is if he returns to Haiti and then he's not brought up on charges and he's sort of somehow exonerated or pardoned, then he will be essentially – it will be difficult then for extradition or for human rights courts or so forth to charge him. So that was part of the calculation. Whether he can play a role in the country, I think, is also – it's very difficult to figure out exactly what that would look like. But there are some people who think he should, and people who think the same way thing about Aristide, that Aristide can play some kind of role in the future. So Haiti's society is fascinating in the way that it deals with kind of conflict and violence and memory. So it's a whole area that – I think is very confusing for people, and it's hard to kind of imagine how this all can be held together. But again, the question I think for many people's minds is these figures are Aristide, I think, in particular. The worries – the U.S. was so worried about his return. And if you were on the ground in Haiti, it seemed, I think, a little clearer that they shouldn't have been. And in a sense, by not letting him go back, they were just making the issue a bigger one. Now that he's back, then the question becomes, well, okay, so what's he going to do and how are we going to interpret that?
Our guest in this part of Focus, let me just again quickly introduce, is Laurent Dubois. He teaches history at Duke. He's written a lot about Haiti and its history, including his new book, Haiti, the Aftershocks of History. We have about 10 minutes left, perhaps left, in this part of the show and have some callers. Others are welcome. You can also send along an email if you'd like to send your question that way. The number is 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have several callers here in this order, starting first with Terre Haute, and that's line four. Hello.
Hello. There was a Marine Corps colonel who was stationed in Haiti. I'm not sure exactly what period of time, but he wrote some books about the situation there. His name was Robert Debs Heinel. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about him and his work, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, thanks. Yes, so Heinel wrote a very long and important history of Haiti called Written in Blood, which covers the history of the country. He was sent there right after Duvalier's election and ended up coming into sort of pretty serious conflict with François Duvalier, although at first he was supposed to be working with him, and ended up penning a very kind of damning portrait of the Duvalier years when he returned to the United States. So his writing, especially about those early years of the Duvalier period, are very important for historians because he had this kind of firsthand vision, although he's a critical observer. There is a journalist, Bernard Diederich, who was also in running for an American paper at that time, who has written several books about that period as well, that I drew on in the book. So those are really important resources. And the book was re-edited by his son and wife, I believe, in a recent edition. So it's certainly a really an interesting resource. And there has been, I draw in the book, I draw on American writers about Haiti, but really I also really tried to bring a lot of the much lesser known Haitian writing about the country to the fore. So I drew quite a bit on all the Haitian historians in the book as well, since their writings are in French and so many people are less familiar with them.
All right. Let's go to Effingham next, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. My question, or no question, but a comment, I think. Can you explain the role of Pope John and Aristide, who was a priest in Haiti? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Absolutely. So one of the many ironies, I guess, of the Duvalier years is that he tried to eliminate any sources of opposition in the country. And one of the sources of potential opposition was the Catholic Church, which was mostly staffed by foreign priests. And so he eliminated deported a lot of the foreign priests who opposed his regime, replaced them with Haitian priests and Haitian bishops. But then that church, because it was Haitian in a way, eventually became even more of a more powerful source of opposition because it was linked to popular religious practice. And Aristide really emerges from that tradition. Pope John comes to Haiti and very famously under Jean-Claude Duvalier a few years before the overthrow, in a famous speech, says something must change here to the gathered bishops of Haiti. And so he, as he did in other places, kind of advocated for human rights and gave some inspiration to priests in the country who were opposing the regime. So that's very important. And so Aristide comes out of that movement and at a certain point kind of embodied that movement of the Catholic Church speaking on behalf of human rights and against the Duvalier regime as well.
All right. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is line number two and in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for bringing up this issue and for developing the history of what's happened in Haiti, because I'm one of those people who just basically never knew anything about it until I read a book by C.L.R. James called The Black Jacobins. And it was a very exciting book to read, and it was just an amazing story. But I would like you to correct me in some of my perceptions, because I have spotty information. But my impression is that basically our relationship with Haiti is an empirical one. And Haiti is essentially a colony with kind of the illusion of being a nation. And that Aristide was driven out as much by CIA activity as anything the first time. And then the second time was essentially kidnapped by the United States and flown to Africa. And another thing that just astounds me is this idea that we would have any right, if supposedly Haiti is a sovereign state, to keep Aristide out. What would possibly be our justification for doing that? Mm-hmm. And I just appreciate the response.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's crucial to understand that the U.S. sort of has for much of the 20th century quite literally seen Haiti as a kind of within its zone of action and has taken actions there that essentially, you know, violated sovereignty and in different ways. So that's certainly the case. The precise details about the coups and the 2004 are just really, really hard to unwind for a historian like me. It's, you know, you can read different tales about them. But in a broader sense, there's no doubt that the U.S. has essentially, you know, seen itself as having the right to intervene into Haitian politics and to manipulate Haitian politics, as it has in many other countries in the Americas going back a long way. So, I mean, I think the question for Haitians is often, you know, when you see U.S. from Haiti, what they'll sort of easily say, well, yes, you're the empire, and our question is how do we have to deal with that? And they, you know, even today, the question is that what we think of as a kind of, you know, development aid or NGOs or all the presence that Americans have in the country can very easily be seen in a very different way by Haitians. So all of that is very vital for us to understand. You know, we look at each other from different histories and from different perspectives. And that's part of what I'm trying to address in the book.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Well, just maybe not to belabor the point, but it seems also important to make the point that as far as the United States is concerned, that Haiti was well within its sphere of influence and it was within our rights to meddle in its politics, go at least back into the early parts of the 20th century, if not into the late parts of the 19th century.
Yeah. I mean, actually, you know, I tell the story in the book. Frederick Douglass was an ambassador to Haiti from the United States, and he was sent essentially with the goal of getting a coaling station. The U.S. wanted to basically get a navy base in Mole Saint Nicolas in the north of the country, which is a very, very strategic location. It's right across from Guantanamo Bay. So there's been a strong strategic interest. And absolutely, I mean, the U.S., you know, recall, also occupied Puerto Rico in 1898 along with Cuba, occupied the Dominican Republic for 10 years at the same time as Haiti. So, you know, Haiti's maybe gotten a particularly intense involvement, but it's also part of a larger history of U.S. interventionism in the Caribbean.
Sure. One more call, at least, in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering what the guest thought about the correlation of the extremely rich to the poor in terms of the type of things that are happening in America.
As soon as we got the call around, we kind of lost him. I think, though, he was interested in, can you draw any parallels between extreme income inequality in Haiti and what people are talking about here in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be a bit of a stretch, but I don't know.
Well, no, it's actually a great question to ask, I think, because, you know, we sometimes assume that, you know, I mean, we know that income inequality in this country is massive and growing. I don't actually have the statistics at my disposal, so I'm not sure that we have them exactly. I'm not sure that the income inequality is actually greater in Haiti than the United States. It may be. But there's plenty of people in different levels in Haitian society. What is striking, of course, in Haiti is that the many people live in very, very extreme poverty and have no sort of safety net. And so that's obviously very evident. And I think so from the U.S., what seems shocking is the kind of contrast between people who are very comfortable and live comfortable lives and then this extreme poverty. But it's sometimes easy to forget that we also live in a country of extremes, I think, when we look at other countries. But there's no doubt that it's also visible in a very different way in Haiti.
Well, we have about a minute. You acknowledge the fact that I think that everybody feels that certainly the rebuilding after the earthquake is something that's going to take a long time, many more years than it's been. So it's only been 2 years. Other things that you think people should just watch for or look at as they watch Haiti now over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, I think, you know, Haiti is also an extraordinary country, and they've overcome many, many things in the past. And I think they're going to overcome and rebuild. I mean, it's a country that has all kinds of positive aspects to it that people often forget about. And I urge people to think about that for those who go and work in Haiti, to go with a kind of open mind and humility and see how they might collaborate and cooperate with what Haitians are looking to do. Because there's a whole side to the country that you know, sometimes we just forget about in the midst of covering all these difficulties. And so I guess that's where I try to lead people. And that, I think I try to bring that in the book as well, the achievements as well as the difficulties of the country.
Well, and for folks who would like to read more about the history of Haiti, the book you can look at is the one we've mentioned, Haiti, the Aftershocks of History, published by Metropolitan Books, by our guest Laurent Dubois. He's professor of history at Duke University. Professor Dubois, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also we want to say thanks to Kennard Blake. He's the technical director on the other end of our connection between here and Duke.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
Coming up on tomorrow's Focus, in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, we'll have a conversation from January of this year with David Scheffer. He's a professor of law and director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University, about his book, All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, another conversation from January of this year. Almost everyone learns at least one language when they're a child. Some might learn two or three, but through history, there have been accounts of some people who learn a lot of languages. Take, for example, Giuseppe Mezzofanti, a 19th century Italian priest who was said to speak 72 languages. Could that have actually been possible? And is there someone alive today who could match it? Michael Erard was curious about that, and he tells the story of his search for the world's most extraordinary language learners. That's the subject of his book, Babble No More. We'll hear a conversation that David Inge conducted with Michael Erard, senior researcher from the Frameworks Institution, about his book, Babble No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. That's in the 11 o'clock hour on Friday. Another intriguing show just to pass along to you on Monday at 10 a.m. We'll listen back to a conversation from March with a writer and attorney named Susan Kane. She has been curious about introverts and what our perceptions are of introverts versus extroverts. You know, we've long been told the happiest people in the world are the ones that are most sociable, gregarious, outgoing individuals, and that introverts, well, there's some reason why they're withdrawn from the world, or that's what we think is going on. Well, she thinks that's maybe not true, and so she talked with David Inge about her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Then a conversation with Adam Leshinsky, senior editor-at-large from Fortune magazine, about his book, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. That's what's coming up on Focus on Monday. The Afternoon Magazine's coming up next here on listener-supported public radio, WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Here are some of the stories we're following at this hour. A Chicago man's accused of plotting to become a suicide bomber overseas. He may change his plea to guilty. Prosecutors and defense attorneys told a judge today they have an agreement on a plea deal for 29-year-old Shaker Masri. We'll have details. Indiana's state government is sitting on cash reserves of $2.15 billion. That's a bigger number than what Governor Mitch Daniels estimated last week. And Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr.'s office has released some new information about the ailment that sidelined him for more than a month. We'll have details on all of those stories coming up. Let's take a look at what's happening in the commodity markets at this hour, starting with Kansas City wheat for July. It's at 836.5, up 15.5. September wheat's at 854, up 23. Chicago wheat for July is at 842, up 34.25. September wheat at 855.5, up 29.25. July corn's at 778.5, up 27.75. September corn at 732, up 28. July soybeans trading at 1636, up 13. August beans at 1586.5, up 15. And September beans at 1557.5, up 16.75. July soybean meals trading at 483.50, up 550. August soybean meal at 469, up 570. July soybean oil at 53.19, down 43 cents. August soybean oil at 53.75, down 7 cents. August live cattle at 117.50 is down 50. October live cattle at 121.77.5, down 37.5. August feeder cattle at 141.22.5, that's up $3. September feeder cattle at 144.12.5, also up 3. July lean hogs at 97.32.5, up $1.37.5. And